Please note that the information and advice provided via the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed or substituted for professional medical advice, counselling, or any other type of therapy or professional advice. I do not provide specific medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. And if you have any concerns about a medical condition, please consult with your GP or other qualified healthcare provider. Please do not disregard professional medical advice or delay seeking it because of something you've heard whilst listening to this podcast. Hi everyone, I'm Rada.
And I'm Giles.
And we're your trusted guides for the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast. The podcast that helps you remember, relearn, rediscover and be inspired by others about what might help you feel good on this journey that we call life.
And we're starting right now on our journey to discover those things you forgot were good for you and inspire you to remember them. So without further ado, let's talk about this week's theme. Hello, and welcome to Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast. This week, we talk to Herb Baker, recently retired from NASA after 42 years of service after spending his career at the Johnson Space Center supporting the Space Shuttle, Space Station and Orion programs, and at the Kennedy Space Center and NASA headquarters. In 2010, he was awarded the NASA Exceptional Service Medal, and he is currently on the board of directors at the NASA Alumni League. In this episode of the podcast, he talks about the importance of teamwork in reaching goals and how every single person's contribution, however seemingly small, is vital to humankind reaching new heights. Well, Herb Baker, it's an absolute pleasure to see you and to speak to you today. You've obviously had an incredible career, an distinguished career, 42 years at NASA. Would I be right in saying it wasn't the usual route one might take to get into working for an organization like NASA?
You actually have no idea how true that is. If you'd like, I'll tell you the story.
We'd love to hear it.
It's very unusual. So I just turned 70. I'm actually proud of the fact that I'm still alive at that age. I did not, you know, the old joke about I would have taken better care of myself if I'd known I was going to live this long. It's true. Most of my ancestors on the father's side, all of the males, none of them lived to see 60. One of my uncles died at 39. My father had a heart attack and a stroke at 51. And so I seriously thought, if I get to 60, boy, I'm doing great. And here I am, 70, going strong. So anyway, back in the days when I was about to graduate from college, 1974, 75, the way you got a job with the government was through taking a test. They called it a civil service exam. I don't know if you know my history, but I grew up here. I went to middle school and high school with the astronauts' kids, and most of my friends' parents, including my mother, were associated with NASA in some way. But even so, I was not a science person. I was more a math guy. So I went into business and got a business degree. And I had a part-time job at the Internal Revenue Service, which happened to be in Austin, Texas, where I was going to school, which is a government agency, of course, working part-time to help pay my way through school. And because I was working at this government agency, I was hearing about these government tests that some of the other employees were taking. And there was a particular one called the PACE, P-A-C-E, Professional and Administrative Career Exam. It was a test you took to advance into a professional career. And so there were these, I still remember, and this was, oh my God, 1974, my coworkers were talking about this test and how hard it was, but they wanted to take it anyway to try to advance it. They had clerical jobs, which was what I was doing. It was a clerical, you know, temporary part-time job. And so being a business major, even having grown up with NASA, it never occurred to me that I could work there someday. I was not a scientist or an engineer, had no plans to try to be an astronaut. And so I've had some idea that certainly I could find a job in business with a good business degree from a very nice school. And so at the same time, though, I thought, well, what will it hurt to take this test? So when you sign up for the test, you indicate on the pencil and paper which cities you would be willing to work in for the government, you know, where there was a government office. And of course, I put Houston, not thinking that NASA was a government agency in Houston, because it never occurred to me again. And so, believe it or not, I took the test. The believe it or not part is that they give you six scores in six different categories, aptitudes, skills, knowledge, to try to find the right career to put you in if they're going to hire you. And so in the six scores, I got the letter after I finished the test. I scored 4 100s and 2 98s.
Wow.
And I honestly thought, oh, they sent me somebody else's letter. This can't be me, right? And so sure enough, within a week or two, NASA contacted me and said, hey, would you like to come interview for a job here? And I'm like, are you kidding me? Yes, I'll be there. Is tomorrow too soon? You know. And so the last part of that story is that I obviously came to Houston as soon as I could and went in for the interview. The guy who interviewed me was the father of one of my good friends in high school. So, you know, which didn't surprise me, I guess. Yeah. So I don't know if that helped or not, but it certainly didn't hurt. And anyway. Anyway, you know, 42 wonderful years later, I feel so blessed and lucky. I was one of those people who got up every day looking forward to going to work. It was just, it's funny to say it like this. There's nowhere on earth I would rather have worked than NASA.
Wow. I was going to say, that story is fascinating. And it's amazing, isn't it, when you look back and you see the different things that happened, the different decisions and the decision points that could have led
just
left or
smallest
right.
Smallest thing can change your
absolutely.
Whole life.
Absolutely. And it sounds like the stars were literally aligned for you to be in NASA. And from what you said as well, it obviously sounded like, you know, when you were growing up in that community that NASA was that kind of real base and that kind of center. Like you said, a lot of people, their parents had jobs there. The community was very much, you know, involved in NASA, and NASA was very much part of it. What do you think that had some kind of subconscious impact on you or the community itself, having that kind of central focus and so many people aligned to the same kind of community?
Well, in fact, to a large extent, the community that grew up and exists today still, of course, was there because of NASA. Mm-hmm. It was what is now the Johnson Space Center, it was called the Manned Spacecraft Center back then, was a cow pasture, literally a cow pasture when I, you know, was in the early 60s, mid 60s, when I was in middle school, when it opened soon after. So literally the houses and the schools and the stores and shops all were built for it makes sense that most of the people who lived there, moved there, had a connection, worked for NASA or one of the NASA contractors. And so, yeah, I played on the seventh grade football team in middle school with the sons of Scott Carpenter and Frank Borman, wow. You know, two legendary astronauts. And then all through the rest of middle school and high school, friends still today with many of the astronauts' kids. And my mother was involved in Skylab Actually, it was usually the father, but in my case, it was my mother who got involved with NASA.
Wow, that's incredible, isn't it? And I mean, where do we start? I mean, I was talking to Giles about you before you came on and we started recording, and I was just like, this is going to be a fascinating chat. I can't wait to find out all about what you've experienced, what you've learned. Maybe one of my questions, first of all, to you is, if there was sort of maybe one or two pivotal moments or things that will stay in your mind forever during that 42 years at NASA, what would they be and what were your reflections about those?
You know, that's an interesting question. One of the things I think a lot about when I was growing up, like most people, I think I was introverted. I certainly had a fear of speaking in front of an audience. I was the band president in my senior year in high school, and so what that meant was, at the end of the year, the big band concert, I had to get up in front of, 300 or 400 parents in the high school auditorium for the end of year concert and announce who the band Beau and Sweetheart were. And I think that was the most terrifying moment of my life. I still remember that day. I think I was literally shaking. You know, I'd never done anything like that. Get up and speaking, just as simple as call out two names, you know, in front of 300 or 400 people. And I think maybe working at NASA and being in such a wonderful intellectual environment with so many smart, courageous people, I think I learned some things like, you know, Don't be afraid to do something, to try something. Don't worry about what other people think about you. And so, in fact, one of my favorite stories is, and maybe this is one of those pivotal moments. I was not in theater or even in U.S. high schools, you typically have a senior play, you know, a musical at the end of the year where. Whether you can sing or dance or not, you're in the high school musical. I wasn't, because I was in the orchestra, because I was the band president. Right, so even my senior play, where people who never before and never since acted on stage, one of them wasn't me. But about 5 years into my career at NASA, one of my friends, coworkers, asked me if I wanted to go watch a community theater performance of I think it was MAME with him, because his wife was in the cast in the show and he didn't want to sit in the audience by himself. And so I thought, well, yeah, sure, I'd love to go. I haven't been to that theater. You know, sounds interesting. Let's go. So I went and I fell in love with it. A wonderful little theater, very talented people. It was, I think it may have been the first time in at least many, many years I had seen a live theater performance. I got so interested that I actually ended up dating one of the cast members in that show. And we're still friends today. She's an entertainment lawyer in California. But anyway, so I thought, you know, wow, how can I get involved in this theater? This community theater is a wonderful thing. And they said, well, We're the next show we're doing is Jesus Christ Superstar, and we need an orchestra for that. You could play in the orchestra. It's like, sign me up.
Wow.
So I did, and so as that show was running, the performances, the orchestra was just sitting just off stage, and so I was very close to the, you know, literally sometimes like 3 feet away from the actors and actresses, the performers. And after, you know, 12 performances of that, and watching that so closely, I thought to myself, I could do that. You know, and I thought, yeah, you know, don't be afraid to try. Don't be afraid to make a fool of yourself. Don't be afraid to go out and worry about forgetting lines. Just do it. And so I auditioned, and I was cast in the show. And since then, I took a long break while I was in the height of my career at NASA, but I've done 20, performed on stage in 20 shows.
Wow, that's amazing.
And I'm now on the board of directors of my local community theater. So,
and
that's one of the most fun things I do is there's nothing, if you've never done it, there's nothing like performing on stage for a live audience.
That's incredible. That's also one of my favorite musicals, actually. So can I ask who you were cast as?
That particular one was Pippin.
Yeah.
And I was just in the chorus.
Amazing.
I also did, I was Fiedka in Fiddler on the Roof. I played in Little Abner. I can't even remember the name of my character now. I recently did Miracle on 34th Street. That was Kris Kringle.
So I was the lead
character. And that's another interesting story, actually. And I don't want to waste all of our time talking about theater, but I had taken a break. Once I did that first 4 or 5 years of shows in the early 80s, and then my job at NASA started taking more time, and I got married and had kids, and I just didn't have time. Wow, excuse me, for it's quite a commitment, auditions and rehearsals and performance, and so I took a 34-year break, and so after I retired in 2017, I thought, wow. You know, my kids have graduated from college. I'm not working any longer. I could get back into theater. And so I thought, well, I'll go back to the local theater here and just try to, you know, ease back into it. You know, can I do something backstage, until I kind of figure out what's going on and who's who and such.
Well, I love that. I love that life lesson actually from theater that probably was very evident in your work in NASA, which was that whole idea about, like you said, just go for it. Don't be afraid. Kind of don't limit your possibilities. Kind of, you know, literally the sky is the limit. And what can we do? What's the, you know, the science possibility, which I think is beautiful.
Yes. So I did do, I worked the sound in the booth for a show. And then the next show coming up, it was getting close to the holidays, was going to be Miracle on 34th Street. And I didn't even audition because I just wasn't ready to do another show yet. And it turned out a woman who 35 years earlier I had been performing with was now on the board of directors of this theater. And she called me and said, hey, they had auditions for Miracle on 34th Street and they didn't get a Kris Kringle. She said, you would be perfect. And I thought, whoa, that's not easing back into it. You know, that wasn't my plan.
Yeah.
And she talked me into it, and it was really difficult at first to kind of get my bearings again and remember how to stand on stage and how to walk, you know, little things like, you know, face the audience and when you turn a certain way and all of these kind of things. And I was struggling for a while. I still remember driving on my way to a rehearsal one day and thinking, this is just too much. I can't do this. There's too many lines. I'm in like every single scene and thinking in my head, how am I going to tell this cast, you know, we'd already started rehearsals that I can't do this. By the time I got there, I thought, damn it, I can do this. And I did. And it was wonderful. I don't know that I ever enjoyed, you know, being the lead in a show any more than that one. And so just another, you know, check mark that, wow, don't let fear of failing stop you from doing something. There's famous quotes you've probably heard, everything you desire is on the other side of fear. And boy, I'm a firm believer. And it's easy to say, you know, and tell somebody that. It's not so easy to be on the listening end and say, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, you're right. I'm going to go forget all of my fears and anxieties and everything and just go for it. It has to kind of happen more gradually, I think. But it's certainly something I like to preach.
Absolutely. So, Herb, tell us a bit about some of the roles that you had at NASA. What was the first kind of role you did?
Well, so one of the first, and so again, I was a business guy. It turns out that about, believe it or not, not everyone who works at NASA is a scientist, engineer, or an astronaut. About 30 to 40%, especially today with computers, IT, social media, you know, back then it was the non-scientist astronauts, engineers were business, finance, HR. But today, again, add in IT and social media, and there's like I said, 30, 40% of most NASA employees are not scientists or engineers or astronauts. We get to work with them every day, which is wonderful. But so, anyway, I first started, one of the first big things, my first 6 months or year, I was just, they rotated us around to different offices to kind of get a feel for everything that was going on. But my first assignment was working on the new spacesuits they were developing for the space shuttle program. This was about 1978-79, and the first space shuttle flight wasn't until 1981, and so they were a couple of years in advance working on the spacesuits, and so I was assigned to help manage, you know, again, I was a junior person at that point, with help manage with some more senior folks the contract that NASA had with Hamilton Standard to design and build, fabricate the spacesuits that would be worn in the space shuttle program. And I did that for a couple of years, and then they actually transferred me to the space shuttle program, space shuttle orbiter vehicle program. So, I still have it here. So we had a contract with Rockwell International to build the space shuttle vehicles.
Right. Yep.
There was a separate contract for the external tank and another contract for the solid rocket boosters and another contract for the main engines. But the contract I worked on was for the orbiter vehicle. And so I was literally buying space shuttles.
That's amazing. And that's probably lots of children out there are just dreaming of that. And lots of adults would dream about that as well.
For $2 billion each. And in fact, this was a gift from Rockwell. You can't read it here probably. But and in fact, you know this is an early model because I don't know how familiar you are with the space shuttle program, but typically the external tank is orange.
Yes.
And that's because the first two shuttle missions, it's super cooled liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen inside. And so they thought they needed to put white paint on it to help protect it from ultraviolet rays to keep it cool. After the first two flights, STS-1 and 2, they realized that they didn't need to do that. And so they just left it its natural orange color. But you know, this is a very, very early model from the early days because it's got a white external tank.
Well, I've actually been to the Air and Space Museum.
I used to go. I spent 10 years at NASA headquarters in Washington, okay. D.C.
Yeah.
I used to go there on my lunch breaks. But anyway, I'd love to hear what you think.
Oh, no. So I've actually seen one of those shuttles up. You know, they've got one there. And it is awe-inspiring because you see this ship and you think, you know, obviously it's not a working one, but it's just incredible to see that a ship like this would have gone up into the atmosphere, out of the atmosphere, into space. And it's just, it's just very, very, it makes you, it's very humbling, actually, to be in the presence of a vehicle like that.
Yeah. I don't take for granted how lucky I was, I feel, to not only have grown up in that environment, but then to get to work at a place like that with those people and so now it's, you know, led to this life that I'm having as much fun as I've ever had because so many people love to hear about those stories. When I retired, I joined the NASA Alumni League, which of course, as it sounds, is a group of former NASA employees who a nonprofit organization. Basically, our main goal is to collect, you know, fundraising and events to provide funding for STEM education and engagement. And I had no plans to do it, but that's kind of a long story too. But I was a fairly active member. I would go to their events, but the president of the board of directors of the Alumni League happened to be a former astronaut that I worked very closely with, Bill MacArthur. And so one of the officers, a secretary, who I was also friends with, decided that she wanted to take a different role. And so she asked me if I would take her job as secretary, you know, go right from just a regular member to the officer on the board of directors. And I'm sure when she asked the president, Bill MacArthur, he said, "Oh, yeah, I know her. Yeah, sure." So suddenly I find myself, you know, an officer on this board of directors of 500 former NASA employees. And it's just incredible. I mean, I got to meet a lot of people in 42 years, but I've got to meet and become friends with even more, mm-hmm. you know, astronauts and flight directors and folks because of the NASA Alumni League, which that actually probably takes up more of my time than anything else I do since I've retired.
So I'm really interested, obviously, because you've worked with a lot of astronauts, scientists, a lot of incredible people with incredible brains, incredible imagination, incredible courage, like you were saying, to kind of, you know, stretch the possibilities of what we can do in terms of the human race and what we're kind of, you know, endeavouring to find out and discover. In your experience, what are the kind of qualities or the psychology that those kind of people have that makes them want to keep trying or makes them want to be part of that that endeavor, I suppose?
You know, the first thing that comes to mind is teamwork. And maybe another way of saying that is it's bigger than you, you know? And I think to me, it's kind of interesting. A lot of people might be surprised to learn that most astronauts, their biggest fear is not dying in an accident. It's screwing up and being the person who messes up the mission because they didn't do their job. That's their biggest fear. They don't want to be the one who wasn't concentrating and paying attention or doing the work they needed to do with the preparation and and they're the ones who didn't get their job done and it ruined the whole mission. And so that was one thing I probably loved most about that job is there was no, maybe there was some, but not noticeable, you know, competition among people for, you know, I want that job. I want that promotion. It was, people would bend over backwards to help you if there was anything they could do you needed, you know, could help you achieve what you were trying to do, help you finish your job, whether or not it meant it might put you, might put them in a higher rung than you that didn't matter. I remember a story. I think it's true. one of the presidents back in the early days, this is before I was even working there, was taking a tour of one of the NASA centers, and he came across a guy mopping the floor, and he asked him, you know, "So what's your job? You know, what do you do?" He says, "I'm helping send people to the moon." And I mean, yeah, that's true. It almost gives me chills thinking about that. It's like it took every one of those people, no matter what your job was, to accomplish that. And that's the way it was for me. And so that I think that's what sticks out most to me.
That's really incredible. And maybe it is because, you know, to work in a place like that and to do the things that people are doing there, it, you know, you seem so kind of connected as a community in that one purpose, that one kind of that one joint and unified thing which brings you all together, which is to find out more about, you know, the universe we live in, and maybe that's why that's so strong. And I love that story. I think that's incredible because, you know, in the world today, you know, there's sometimes you look around and you see, you know, selfies and people talking about themselves all the time and self-promotion everywhere. Not that there's anything wrong with self-promotion, but it's very interesting to hear your reflections about the importance of teamwork and the importance of every single person in that team, and the fact that they're all contributing something, even if they're not the front face of whatever it might be, or they haven't got a certain title, they're all part of this big process and this bigger journey, if you like, this bigger sort of meaning and mission that you're all on.
Yes, and so to continue answering your question, after I finished a couple of years working in the shuttle orbiter procurement section, I was moved over to the space station program. This was in the mid-1980s, so it was 13 years before we flew the first element. And then, actually, it was kind of an interesting career after that. I went from space shuttle to space station, back to space shuttle, back to space station, and then I think was in shuttle again. And none of these were my, you know, request. It was, it just happened that at least the last 20, 25 years or so, my boss liked to move people around, you know, didn't want to get you stale and yeah, you know, doing the same job over and over. And of course, I never complained. I especially, you know, who's going to complain about getting to work in the space shuttle program or the space station program, even if I'm just going back and forth. And then I even worked in the Orion program for a couple of years. But then they moved me, again, without asking, to what's called flight operations, which was essentially it's the astronaut office and astronaut training and the aircraft operations at the nearby local airport. And so that was just amazing. Supporting the flight operations, they gave me special access, especially because I had such a history, you know, back from when I was a teenager of being on site covering the Apollo missions. Did I even tell that story? I do so many of these. So here, in fact, today is the 51st anniversary of the launch of Apollo 15.
Oh, wow.
And I was working for the news media.
Wow.
Ah.
That's amazing.
I still have my job. In fact, I still have, I also worked covering Apollo 11, Apollo 12, Apollo 13. That was
wow.
A fun one.
Wow.
And some of the Skylab missions. So let me back up a little bit. So again, growing up in this community in the 1969 and 70, and this is before the internet or videotape, the TV networks in the U.S. would send crews down from their headquarters in New York City cover the missions, and they would rent a trailer, a mobile home, and park it on site at the manned spacecraft center, and set up a studio, you know, camera and a backdrop and a desk and microphone, and would bring astronauts in to interview. And so, so I got to, you know, see and meet and hang out with Apollo astronauts back then, even those I didn't know otherwise, because I was, you know, their friends with their child. Now I forget the purpose of this story, but one of my favorite parts of that story was for Apollo 12. It was struck by lightning actually on the launch, and that's another story. A 26-year-old flight controller saved the launch because he knew of a switch you could flip to reset the power in the command module because it had been shut down because of the lightning. But my main job for those TV news media companies back then was, again, because there was no videotape or internet, if you filmed an interview with an astronaut or a flight director or something like that, you had to physically move the film from New York or from Houston to New York so they could put it, play it on the television. And so my main job was twice a day to drive the 100-mile round trip, which I did this morning for my wife, to drop her off. She's on her way to Pittsburgh, to drop off film to put on a plane to fly to New York.
Wow.
But Apollo 12, when it was coming home, Pete Conrad, who was the third guy to walk on the moon, they wanted a local human interest story. So this wasn't some film that needed to be sent to New York. It was just for the local TV station. They wanted a film of his family in their home, just a few miles from here now, although they don't live there anymore, watching the splashdown into the South Pacific on the TV set in their living room. And so they sent me and a cameraman to Pete Conrad's home. And so I was in his living room with his family watching their TV as Apollo 12
wow.
splashed down into the South Pacific. And I still remember, this was over 50 years ago. I remember this like it was yesterday. The cameraman, I could draw you a picture of the rooms in their house. I remember it so well. We walked from the living room into the dining room, and he put the camera in a black bag so he could take the film out of the camera and put it into a canister and handed me the canister. And I got in my car and drove back to the Space Center, which was only about 5 or 10 minutes away. There was a helicopter waiting for me. The local TV station was so anxious to get this film. It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They wanted it for the 5 o'clock news, right? I guess they didn't want to take a chance on me, I don't know, having an accident or a flat tire or running out of gas or something. So they hired a helicopter to fly me the 15 miles from the Space Center to their TV studio. And I still remember the helicopter pilot had just come back from Vietnam. I mean, this is 1969. And holding on, I'd never been in a helicopter before. I'm 17 years old. It's zooming down the interstate, barely above the power lines. And I still remember him having to find a place to park the helicopter, run across, five lanes of traffic. And I walked in the building. I still remember there was a desk over to the right. There was a woman who was waiting for me. She knew I was coming. And I remember handing her the canister. And I don't remember anything after that. It's like the adrenaline just drained. I don't even remember the helicopter ride back to my car.
Wow. Well, I mean, Herb, you mentioned a really important and really interesting thing there about being with the family, of someone who went up into space and actually witnessing their reaction and their feelings, their emotions, obviously when they came back from that. What, in your experience, what do you think the impact, obviously it's going to be different for different people, but what do you think the impact is on individuals, astronauts that have gone up into space, on their families, but also in terms of the wider team when actually a mission is accomplished?
Yeah, that's interesting. And of course, people ask me, what was their reaction? And it was mostly just relief. Mm. And astronauts will tell you this still today, that it's when they go into space, they're risking their life. And they are. I mean, we lost 17 astronauts, 3 in Apollo 1 fire and 7 in Challenger and 7 in Columbia. But They say it's harder on my family than it is on me. I'm the one who gets to go up and have the fun, assuming I make it back, and enjoy doing what I've spent most of my life trying to accomplish. They're the ones stuck at home, worried about, am I going to make it back or not, and having to take care of everything in my absence and all that. And so I think, especially for the wives, of the male astronauts, and today it's reversed sometimes. It's just that, praying that their spouse makes it home safely and just this huge sense of relief when they're back on the ground. And that's pretty much all they think
about.
Yeah,
and I suppose as a result of that, valuing life, I suppose more their perspective maybe changes on certain things. It's very interesting to know that. And obviously that's a very individual thing. Why do you think, and again this may be an obvious question, but I'm interested in your views, why do you think humans are so fascinated by space and the universe? What is it that makes us keep trying to do different things, do you think?
I can only guess or speculate, and you might get a different answer from someone else, but it seems to be exploring. I mean, from back in the early days of whoever you want to give credit to, Columbus sailing across the Atlantic to discover America, and the Wright brothers, you know, flying, you know, taking off in the plane, and there seems to be something built into our DNA that wants us to know, you know, what's out there and what's on the other side of that hill and what's in that cave and what's at the bottom of the ocean. And, you know, just so much of the universe and Earth and our solar system to learn about, so many people feel very strongly about wanting to do that. And it's a great thing. I love being around people like that.
I mean, we could talk to you all day because you are fascinating. You've got so many amazing stories, and I wish actually we could come and visit you and see all of the things that you've got in that room, because it looks incredible.
Oh, I did get to meet
Tim Peake.
Oh wow!
Yes,
wow. People listening, he has a picture of Tim Peake, and
he and I have communicated on Twitter a couple of times.
That's incredible. I love that. Our podcast is called Things I Forgot Were Good for Me. So all the things that maybe we knew once when we were little that we've kind of got squeezed out as we got older, or maybe we've just totally forgotten about kind of the benefits of. So in your view, what would that one thing be for you, that thing that maybe a lot of us have forgotten about in society or individually that's good for us but we're not really doing enough of?
That's an interesting question too, because to me I feel like I have a hard time thinking of something that would be a really great answer to that. My experience is more as I was growing up, you know, more, maybe I was a late bloomer in my 20s, you know, I started realizing things like, wow. Well, and not only for me, you know, being a 20-year-old was 40 years ago. So it depends on what you look at as being younger. Right. But I guess the things like that come to mind so it's more of a case of realizing something than remembering something that, you know, I thought of as a child. But going back to don't worry about what other people think about you. You know, I think I must have been in my 30s or 40s when it finally sunk into me, you know. People aren't thinking about you and judging you and hanging on every word that you're saying in front of this crowd nearly as much as you think they are. You know, they're thinking about, oh, what am I going to have to do tonight? Oh gosh, I wonder if I can get out of work early. And that was very freeing. You know, I'm not going to let that fear of what that person might be thinking or again, you know, worrying about making a mistake or failing or not looking good just because someone out there may not like that. I'm going to go for it. You know, if I fail, I fail. Which is another space kind of thing. If familiar with the a movie Apollo 13 or Gene Kranz is a, you know, legendary flight director. He was the flight director when Apollo 11 landed on the moon, and he of course helped save Apollo 13. One of the flight directors involved in that, and so, and he never said. You may have heard the phrase "failure is not an option," and he his character in the movie said that. He never actually said that. Well, working at NASA, it was just a phrase written in the script for the movie, but he kind of took it on, you know, and his book is titled Failure is Not an Option. And he signs most things now, Failure is Not an Option, Gene Kranz. And you know, if three astronauts' lives are depending on you doing a good job, then maybe failure is not an option. Otherwise, it's a requirement. I mean, my goodness, you know.
I love that.
I mean, seriously, you've heard... I know you've heard, you know, if you're not failing, you're not trying hard enough. That's true. It's absolutely true. And so, you know, I think, and so that's one of the things I do a lot of speaking to students and, you know, even third graders. I've done a lot of speeches to third graders and middle school and high school and college students. But, you know, I think that's the one thing I try to preach more than anything is just don't be afraid of what someone's going to think. Don't let it stop you from doing what you want to do. And that's something that, I, you know, again, it's not really a perfect answer to your question, but it's something that I wish I had learned even earlier than I did.
I think it is the most perfect answer, actually, that you could ever have come up with. I really, really do. Because that limits so much of what we kind of turn our hand to. So I think it's an absolutely perfect answer. Herb, you are absolutely incredible. Honestly, you really are. Will you have me and Giles over there sometime? Will we come and see you?
Oh, yes, I would. I would love to show you around Houston. I think maybe I mentioned when I started working supporting the flight operations director and got to work directly in support of the astronaut office and astronaut training, and they gave me special access to the neutral buoyancy lab, if you're from the big swimming pool where they train underwater spacewalks and mission control rooms. Wow. and what they call the space vehicle mock-up facility, where they have life-size, full-size, high-fidelity mock-ups of the space station and the space shuttle, where they trained when they, you know, they trained in the pool when they were going to do a spacewalk outside. When they're living inside, they train in the mock-up facility. And so they gave me special access to those facilities that even most other NASA employees didn't have, so that I could take people on tours.
Wow.
And so, you know, because I know stories and history and things that most other people don't know. And in fact, it was kind of funny. Even after I retired, there was a group of NASA employees from other NASA centers in other parts of the country who were meeting in Houston, and they wanted to be taken on a tour of the, you know, local Houston facilities. And a woman in HR who I knew called me and said, "Hey, would you know, we got this group in town who want to do a tour. Would you lead the tour?" And I said, "You know, I'm retired, right?" and she said, "Yeah, I know, but we want you to do it anyway." Okay, you know, you're going to have to give me, because I had to give up that special privilege and access when I retired. I had to turn my badge in that was coated with the, you know, the strip that would let me enter those places. But anyway, they did. And so, yeah, I in fact, the last week of my career was during the holidays, and so not much happens anyway. There was such a demand for people, family and friends wanted to be taken on tours, that I did 10 tours my last 5 days, one in the morning and one in the afternoon, all 5 days that week.
So you did matinees. And
that was it.
Matinees.
But so anyway, yeah. Anyway, the reason I thought of that is so now when someone wants a tour, some people get confused. So there's the NASA Johnson Space Center, which is adjacent to, next door to Space Center Houston, which is a nonprofit, private institution. They're obviously interconnected, but they're entirely separate entities. And it's funny because some people think they're going you can't just go visit the Johnson Space Center. You have to have an ID badge, and people try to drive on and they get redirected to, no, you have to go through. And you can't actually, if you go into Space Center Houston, you can take a tram, you know, on site and visit a couple of buildings with a tour guide that works for Space Center Houston. So anyway, again, I'm rambling on, but what I do now is if someone comes in and wants a tour, I take them over to Space Center Houston and give them a tour of that museum, because again, I know, you know, stories and history and things I can point out that most people would miss. And then let them get on the tram and go around the Johnson Space Center. And so, but anyway, yeah, no, absolutely. If you ever make it to Houston, please let me know.
I'd love to show you around. Thank you, Herb.
Yeah, Herb, thank you so much for your time today. It's been really wonderful to talk to you, and fascinating career and life you've had. And 42 years is incredible. Congratulations to you for that, and hope you're enjoying your time. It sounds like you're busier than ever.
Yes. I actually just did another podcast yesterday with another guy, Adam Page in the UK. He's wanting to, you know, thinking, hoping about maybe trying to become an ESA astronaut. And,
wow.
So yeah, I nothing more I'd rather do than this kind of thing, talking about NASA. And so thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Really appreciate your time.
So that's the end of another Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast episode. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope it's inspired you to go looking for all of the things that might help you feel a little bit better.
And hopefully we've inspired you to go looking for our podcast. You can find it on all good podcast platforms, probably some of the bad ones as well. You can also find us on social media. Our handle is Radha.
Yes, Giles, absolutely. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Forgot Podcast. So go and find us there. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next week.